The word that I use for her privately is that she was a professional, which is an extremely unkind word, because Danny was an innocent and she was not. She managed to draw him into an affair. Danny made the decision, and after he made that decision, Swami supported him that he should stay with his wife. Swami didn't tell him to stay with his wife, but when Danny made the decision to stay with his wife, Swami supported him. It's an important distinction. And then when Anne-Marie didn't want to cooperate with that, Swami told her that he simply could not allow her to just sit at the village and destroy Danny's marriage. She would have to go live somewhere else at Ananda. And Swami said himself, when he made that decision, he knew that there would be enormous consequences to that decision, but it was the right decision. He was just going to make it. And where there is Dharma, there is victory. So when everything else came to pieces and it all came, the whole story came out, even when people knew that Danny had gotten himself in trouble in this way, Danny had turned his life back around and was trying to go in the right direction. And it was an infatuation. People who were more objective could see who she was, but when somebody's infatuated, you can't tell them. But people supported Danny instead of turning and condemning him. And which is, you know, how dare you behave like this? You're a minister in the community. You shouldn't have done this, like this kind of energy. And ultimately, when we're sitting in the courtroom, we're being excoriated because we didn't do that to Danny. I mean, that's really how it came down. You know, the way they twist things, it's like, don't you have any standards? You should have protected. You should have done this. How dare you allow this to go on? How could you have, you know, and it's like, you, because a courtroom is such an unnatural setting, you can't defend yourself against that. But I realized that what we were being excoriated for was the fact that we stood by our friend. We wanted to help him recover from a case of poor judgment. We wanted to have him know that no matter what happened, we were still family. We wanted to support his wife and his child in this. I mean, that was what was really, really came back on us. Isn't that strange? And I said I would rather go down in flames than give up that way of being. You know, if we'd kicked Danny out and humiliated him publicly, that would have been considered the right thing. Not really, because people were just playing. But isn't it strange? But Swamiji, it was just natural to us. I mean, because that's how Swamiji has always related to all of us. It was just so bizarre to have him be portrayed as this mean, judgmental, abusive person. Every person who's part of Ananda, whether you know Swami directly or not, because everything that you receive from Ananda is what Swami has set in motion. I mean, there's one element, which is kindness and a forgiving attitude, which is everyone makes mistakes. If we don't have a chance after we've made a mistake, well, Swamiji put it in a slightly different way. He said, if I expected my friends to be perfect, I would be a very lonely man. You know? And if God expected us to be perfect, he wouldn't have very many devotees. And so Swamiji, lying in the bedroom of his parents' house, staring at the ceiling and wishing to die, just ran through all of these different thoughts in his mind. You know, what does a devotee do in a moment like this? And he describes, you know, there were the three choices, I think, as he put it. You can learn from it, you can become angry, you can go for revenge. What would be the point? And he just made this profound and conscious decision with all his willpower that they are my friends, and if I'm not their friend anymore, that doesn't mean that I'm not going to extend friendship to them. And he made the decision that he would do the right thing. Sometimes I joke with people, sometimes you find yourself in circumstances where you just can't affect what's going on around you. The world won't cooperate, or you owe too much money to ever be able to earn enough, or whatever it might be. And I always say, just do your dharma, do the right thing in a vacuum. Like, don't think about the consequences, don't think about the world beyond you. Don't think too rationally and reasonably. Just take your little piece of consciousness and direct it in the right way, because that's really all that God asks of you. If still you fail miserably, what difference does it make? And so Swamiji had that question in, you know, on a level that few of us will ever be asked to answer it. But just what is the right thing to do? And even as he describes it, when his parents' friends would say, Why aren't you living in the monastery anymore? Because, of course, all his parents' friends knew, because he was the oldest son and he'd been living in the monastery for 14 years and they all knew where he was. He said, it would have been easy for me to lie. He said, well, they threw me out. And then he didn't say any more. He said, I didn't want to rationalize what had happened to me, because I wanted to be completely open and to be able to hear whatever might be true. Just think, it's so, when you really project yourself all the way into the circumstances of his life and hear the decisions he made and how he decided to handle what happened to him, it's just such an extraordinary example for all of us in these little, and he's so generous too. He says, I'm not going to say that I suffered more than other people suffered. You know, very difficult things happen to everyone. My case wasn't worse. He just happens to be telling his own story. But, you know, many terrible tragedies happen to people. And that inclination to justify yourself. In Hope for a Better World, there was that phrase that I liked too much, where it talked about how it was difficult to change habits, because our habits send deep roots into the subconscious, winding through subterranean caverns of ancient self-justifications, unresolved disappointments and hurts. But that particular phrase, ancient self-justifications, is the one that strikes me, because Swamiji was talking about that. Because how will you ever know what's true if you're so busy explaining what's true? He wanted to just to be able to hear it, and to just go forward with a loving attitude no matter what. I mean, he has a few things in here, maybe it comes later, where he talks about Tara used to call him up and just excoriate him for long periods of time. Now, the most obvious thing in the world was to hang up the telephone. And he deals with it in just a simple way. It was a rudeness of which I was not capable. And you hear that and you think, it's just, you don't actually know what to do. You don't know whether he's a fool or a rishi when you hear that. Is this man a saint, or is he just like, does he not function? I mean, hang up the phone. But hanging up the phone is a gesture of rejecting. You know, it's like, I don't need to hear this anymore. I don't want to hear this anymore. And Swamiji made the inward decision that he was not going to reject this test. He was not going to try to protect himself from it. Whatever was going to come, he was just going to let it come. This belonged to him. Now, just imagine, again, having that much courage. How could you? That's interesting, that particular quality of Swamiji's. It came out also in the middle of the Bertolucci trial, because these two girls, especially this girl named Kamala and her obedient sidekick, imposed themselves upon Swamiji, and that is actually the word, because I was there at the time, I knew. People were very respectful of Swamiji's privacy, and you just didn't go to his house unless you had a reason to go. But not Kamala. She would just come in whenever she wanted to come into his house. And she would go downstairs into his room, she would go down to his bedroom, and she actually literally would go into his bed. And when he was in seclusion, he came down to see her. She just imposed himself on her. And, I mean, she just imposed herself on him. I have to say the grammar right. And the obvious thing is, well, why didn't you kick her out? He said, well, that would have been rude. And he said, I mean, no, that sounds ridiculous, unless you know him. And then he said, now I would have done it. Meaning, if I had known how she would betray me, now I would have done it. I would have been rude to her. But there was another reason for it, which is just extremely important, which is just his awareness of how his energy impacts people. And, you know, to be unkind to someone, to make them feel rejected, he recognizes that has a lot of force. And he didn't want to be rude to her. But he didn't want to be rude to Tara either. He didn't want to be rude to anything that life forced upon him. And think how casually the rest of us just accept and reject at will all the time. We're always just, you know, asserting ourselves. It's a tricky business, and I always make a caveat, you know, you have to be psychologically healthy to be a good devotee. You can't just behave a certain way out of cowardice. Swamiji has all the courage in the world to do anything, so he can make a conscious decision. He's free. His actions are freedom. They're not based on fear, which is a difference. But then he just lay on that bed and he just thought and he thought day after day, what am I supposed to do? And he had this dilemma in his mind too. See, nothing is assumed. He just doesn't assume, I know what Master wants. I know what I should be doing. It was, what do you want, Master, with just this total receptivity. And even when Dr. Chaudhary and Bina met him, Haridas Chaudhary and Bina, and tried so hard to draw him in, his first response was, I can't do this. Because everybody that he'd been listening to his whole life had told him that he shouldn't. And also, it was just like this excess of care, of caution now. You know, I'm on my own completely. You have to see, he was completely on his own. And so he was going to have to figure out every move himself, what is really going to be the right thing to do here. And he had to be very, very careful because he had no safety net anymore. He didn't have gurubais or monks or spiritual superiors, and he really hasn't since for the rest of his life. He's never had peers. He's lived his entire life without peers. He's had very devoted friends. I mean, more than just students, but true friends, very devoted friends, but not peers. He's never had peers. Ever since he was 36 years old, he lost them all. All his friends have just repudiated him. Just unthinkable, isn't it? But the balance point is now that there's thousands of people around the world who would do anything for him. You know, karma comes to zero. All the opposite have a down. Every wave on the ocean that goes up has a wave that goes down. And finally, what difference does it make? He's excoriated on one hand and then adored on the other. And it, ultimately, what does it matter? So he developed these principles. He could see what SRF had done wrong in terms of not understanding the importance of people. People are more important than things. He says that over and over again. It keeps reappearing. People are more important than things. People are more important even than the rules that are made to guide the people. He's just like, and that's why I recall, Ananda's been extremely good at this. What Swamiji was doing in those early years, that's what I was starting to say when I was talking about the two groups. The group that Swamiji trained, he trained in right consciousness and right attitude. And I know in this book he says, the other group was building the community by figuring out how the land would be used and trying to get social organizations and, you know, those all sorts of things. And Swami sort of felt, let them do whatever they want because that really won't make any difference. What is really going to build Ananda is the right consciousness that is being cultivated in this group of people. And that right consciousness was all exactly the right things that he's puts here, the exact opposites, the understanding what is the true purpose of what we're doing. The organization is not an end in itself. It's just a collective form through which we can project energy. What is the purpose of Ananda itself is to help the individual spiritually. And there really is no reality. You know, and the absolute, absolute necessity of putting Dharma first. I mean, to such an extent that I don't think there's hardly anyone in Ananda who could not put Dharma first. You just know so deeply from all the years of training that Swami put into us that it just won't work. It's not tempting because it won't work, among other things. You know that as soon as you veer off the path of Dharma, and all the time we have this beautiful example of SRF to show us what happens if we don't behave that way. They've been just so much our friends. That's why the whole story of SRF is the story of Ananda. But because they have exemplified and imposed upon Swami everything that we never want to impose upon anyone else. And of course, individuals lose their center from time to time and do things that we wish we didn't do. But that's quite different than losing track of the basic principles. I used to joke in the early years of Ananda, which was so... It was such an idyllic period. I mean, physically it was so tough, but it never felt tough at all. It was just idyllic. But people were so just honest and good, and we lived way out in the woods. You could leave thousands of dollars just sitting out on a table and no one would touch it. You couldn't leave a plate of cookies, though. Everybody would just take one. It was truly like ancient India. A friend of mine, a Swamiji, an acquaintance, who's a wandering sadhu, had been a wandering sadhu in India. He used to wander around and he used to try to find places where television hadn't yet reached. It became more and more difficult as time went on. I mean, I first met him some 20 years ago. And he talked about, he said, the quality of consciousness in those villages in India was, he said, you know, you could lose a valuable diamond ring and drop it on the road. He said, you could come back weeks later and it'd still just be sitting there. No one would touch it because it wasn't theirs. They would just leave it there. He said, once television reached the village, though, all of that would go away because it just completely corrupted the moral system that was in place. But when he said that, I said, oh, that was Ananda was always like that. Now there's a lot more coming and going of people who aren't so well involved. I was talking about when it was very isolated at the retreat and there was just nobody near us who wasn't trained in these attitudes. And Swamiji's comment also, which he made more recently, was if the consciousness is... He was talking about people's passion for systems and for organizing things in certain ways. And there was this whole movement to make some certain organizational changes within Ananda, and Swami was resisting them. It's just too complicated a system. We don't need a system like that. He said, if the consciousness is right, any system will work. And if the consciousness is wrong, no system will work. So there's just no point. You just have to cultivate it from the right end. And that was, again, what he was beginning to understand. You know, just lying there at his parents' house trying to figure out what he was going to do. And then the Chaudhuries got a hold of him, and that it was a friendship that lasted for a long time. Haridas, Dr. Chaudhury, died quite a number of years ago, 2025 maybe. Bina's still alive. She's elderly, and I talked to her not too long ago, and she just talked about, Swami was like a son to them, in his devotion to India and the way they treated him and he treated her. And he was such a light. Oh, and I know I was going to tell you because you asked this. There's an interesting little sidelight to this. Bina told me this story more recently, that when Haridas came from India, he was a disciple of Sri Aurobindo. And he lived in India. I asked Bina, I said, how did you all end up over here? Because he came quite early. And that enterprise, the Cultural Integration Fellowship or the American Institute of Asian Studies, they're kind of like companion organizations. They're still going strong. I think you can get PhDs from, they run like a college now. I think Dr. Chaudhry had been a professor of some sort. And he was a disciple of Aurobindo. And she told me exactly, but I think it was, he was just there in India, and then some disciple of Aurobindo or Aurobindo himself said, they need someone in San Francisco, you should go. And just sort of like out of nowhere, he just picked up and moved to America, and he lived the rest of his life here. And, you know, Bina, his dutiful wife, had to come also. It was harder on her at the beginning, but she adjusted. So he was here in San Francisco, and Master heard that, because I guess they're Bengalis, the Chaudhuries, and so is Master. The Master's here. This is like, what would this be? Well, Swamiji was there in the early 60s, so this might have been the 40s or the 50s. When this was happening, maybe in the 50s. Well, Master died in 52, so it couldn't have been. It was right around the end of the 40s, maybe. And Master heard that another Bengali had come to America representing Sri Aurobindo, and Master sent an invitation to him. Bina wasn't yet in America. And Master sent an invitation and said, you know, if you can come to Southern California, I would love to have you here. So he went down, and Master hosted him, and Bina was telling me, so she couldn't tell me much more than that, except that Master was there and how gracious he was. And she also just talked about how extremely helpful Master was. Here he was setting up another ashram. He wasn't a follower, but Master gave him advice about working with Americans and, you know, just, you know, the kind of practical things that Master knew because he had been there longer and Haridas was new to the country, and just kind of helping them out. And isn't it interesting that then he played such an important role, and Dr. Chaudhry himself said, you know, Master was telling me, I could feel your guru telling me not to take no for an answer, but I had to get you to do this. How? Who knows what the lila was there, whether Master implanted in him at that time the power to be able to play such a key role in Swami's life. Perhaps something else would have happened, but really if it hadn't been for Dr. Chaudhry, and even at that critical moment when Swamiji was ready to go off into seclusion and he was heading off to Mexico, And Dr. Chaudhary had his heart attack, and then he just couldn't do it. And by the time that year was finished, he was really settled in to San Francisco, and he spent that whole year working on this book. And by that point, the energy had turned. And so the die was cast, and Swamiji could see the direction he was going. The other thing that, of course, is in here, and Swamiji gives us like the cliff notes on crises in modern thought, Out of the Labyrinth, it's presently called. That book, is it's